Hello, once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop. WAMC is the name of the radio station. Our license has just come in. It's WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Joe Donahue, in for Ray Graff. Here to take your climate change and alternative energy questions is Dan DeLory, Senior Fellow for Energy and Climate at Vermont Law and Graduate School. With over 25 years of experience, including as an executive with utilities and clean energy companies, Dan is the former White House Director of Clean Energy, where he focused on the decarbonization of the nation's electricity system. A UN-accredited delegation head to the UN climate change meetings known as COPs, Dan is considered a pioneer in developing content, policy, and programs that combine climate change with new electricity technologies. The number to join us, we always get a lot of calls for this show, so if you'd like to get in early, now's the time. 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Again, 1-800-348-WAMC, 1-800, it's 1-800-348-2551. You can also email us, WAMC.org. Dan DeLory, how are you?
I am good, Joe. It's a pleasure to be with you today.
Very nice to be with you. Thank you very much for coming in and doing this. A lot to talk about, I think. You know, I was just reading your introduction, I thought to myself, here's a guy who was the former White House Director of Clean Energy. We don't have one of those now, do we?
That's a good question. I don't believe we do. Yeah. I don't believe that position exists.
Your job would be easier now, I would assume. It would be less to go out and about, right?
I guess that's one way of putting it.
Yeah.
Yes.
So when you were in... when you look at how people are trying to keep up with, let's say there are different policies for different administrations. And then we get into right after the Biden administration, there was a lot of talk and different programs that were put into place, and people could take advantage of those programs. A lot of those programs are gone. Boom. Kaput. However, some still exist a little bit. We have some time. We can still get in as far as incentives, as far as programs that'll help us integrate these clean technologies. But time is ticking.
Yeah, most definitely. It's certainly the case that the larger perspective, the entire U.S. clean energy policy and climate policy and programs has been rolled back and continues to be rolled back. But from a tactical sense, there are some tax incentives that are still available to people. These were included in the Biden Inflation Reduction Act. They have been eliminated in the big budget bill, as I call it, of the current administration, but not just yet. They're right now in a period where you can still obtain these, you can still do the projects, do the work, and get the incentive. And I'll give you a website in a moment that you can go to get more information than I'm capable of doing here. I don't want to give people any tax advice or installation advice or whatever.
Sure.
But the first one to expire is the one for electric vehicles, which expires on September 30th. Okay, that is a big one, $7,500. I myself took advantage of it 2 years ago. And there are different options. Some cars, because of foreign content, you get that by leasing an EV. And I've seen where leases are available for like $100 a month on EVs, on some EVs right now. And otherwise, if you buy one that's eligible for the tax credit, now you can actually get that reduced at point of sale from the dealer. So that's the EV one. The solar ones for installing solar panels on your roof are expiring at the end of the year on December 31st. And I think the project has to be completed by then. And that's one aspect you've got to look at if you're looking to take advantage of any of these. Is some of them, you know, you have to buy it, you have to have it installed. Some you have to have begun the project.
I don't know enough about, I mean, I know about the technology. I don't know enough about the installation, but is that possible in this period of time to get that done now?
If you're talking about the solar installation?
Yes.
I think, and don't take this for gospel, but I think the only constraint is that the solar installers they've got some pretty long lines of people who want to get this. But I don't want that to discourage anyone. If you've been thinking about putting solar panels on your roof, now is the time to at least have somebody do the analysis or do a self-analysis that you can find online.
Dan DeLury is our guest on Vox Pop this afternoon. We welcome your phone calls, 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Before I go to the calls, let me just ask you about, so when you think, let's take EVs, for example.
Sure.
We have EVs. And you have these incentive programs, and more people that get these vehicles, the better, and we're looking good. But if we're not, are we doing all we can on the other side to provide the plug-in stations, to do the work, to do the maintenance and so forth? I mean, is that going to fall by the wayside? If I'm thinking about buying an electric vehicle and I know that for one reason or another the government isn't being overly helpful in this regard, how happy am I going to be running into the dealership?
Yeah, no, there's several comments to make on that, but I do want to loop back to the incentives.
Sure.
Because there's one that I didn't get to.
Okay.
And that is home energy efficiency improvements, which is an umbrella term that can include various things like heat pumps or energy efficient weather stripping or things like that. Those incentives are available until mid-year of 2026. And here's the website I would recommend, among others, NRDC.org. That's the Natural Resources Defense Council, but they've got a guide for consumers with respect to expiration of the tax incentives.
NRDC.org.
Correct.
All right.
So one good piece of news with respect to the EV world is that the administration tried to cancel and not hand out the money that was already passed and allocated to building EV chargers nationwide. And that money is now, there's been a court decision, that money has to be made available, and the states are in the process of reapplying that. But I think the larger issue here is, what does this mean to not have this EV tax incentive? Now, it means that you're going to have a little bit of a slowdown. It was such a major incentive. But I want to mention Ford Motor Company, which just announced that they are staying the course on EVs. They may make some adjustments in terms of their internal combustion line versus their EV line. But I think Ford recognizes, and they've said as much, that the EV market is worldwide. I mean, China last year built more EV facilities and factories and production in other countries than it did at home. There's a Chinese EV company called BYT that is considered to be one of the best and, importantly, cheapest EVs in the world. And so any U.S. manufacturer who wants to compete on a worldwide basis has to go EV, because that's what the world is doing. I mean, I could expand that, but we could talk too long about that. That basically everything that is happening in the U.S. with respect to clean energy is the opposite of what is happening in other countries.
Wow. Okay. Well, that's interesting, and we'll see how that goes down the line. Let's go to the phones and check in with folk who are here to talk to Dan. Julie is in Troy. Hello, Julie. How are you?
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
A pleasure.
My question is twofold. My husband and I put a solar array on our property in 2008, and it's been great. It's lived up to everything we were hoping for. However, the solar panels are so much more powerful now. We're thinking that we want to upgrade. So two questions. Would we still qualify for any kind of tax incentive to do that? And secondly, is there any place we can go to find out the ratings and the performance of solar companies as far as trustworthiness and, I don't know.
Sure.
Customer satisfaction.
Sure. Great question.
Well, first, Julie, I want to congratulate you on being an early adopter going back to 2008 and for giving the great endorsement that you did in terms of the performance of the panels and so on. And I think, unless I'm mistaken, when you talk about more powerful, the panels have become more efficient. It's not really a powerful issue, but it's how much electricity can they produce after the sun falls on them. And so, yes, the efficiency has gotten better, and hopefully that will get better over time. Having said that, though, I do not know the answer to your question about whether or not the fact that you've got that already, how that impacts you to get a tax incentive for the replacement. But the final thing you asked about, which is the rating of solar companies, each state, which has an energy office, although it may not be by that name, in New York State it's called NYSERDA, they have approved contractor lists for this and other things. When I installed heat pumps in my home last year in Vermont, I consulted the Vermont list for contractors that were approved by the state. And so that's what I would point you to. If there are other ways to do that, I don't recall any right at the moment.
Julie, Okay. Good luck. Thank you very much for the call. Okay. I appreciate it. Be
Thank
well.
You. Bye-bye.
We have more calls, and that frees up a line for you. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. We are talking about climate change and alternative energy. On the Vox Pop this afternoon, Dan DeLury is our guest, and you can talk to him right after this short break. Welcome back to Vox Pop. I'm Joe Donahue speaking with Dan DeLury on Vox Pop this afternoon. We welcome your calls, 1-800-348-2551, talking about climate change and alternative energy. We go to Joanne now in Ticonderoga. Hello, Joanne.
Yeah, recently the nuclear power industry has reared its ugly head, and they're now promoting themselves as a source of green energy. Even the governor of New York is suddenly out promoting, let's install more nuclear power plants in New York State. And specifically, they're promoting opening up old power plants located on the Great Lakes or building new ones along the Great Lakes. The Great Lakes are like one of the top sources of fresh water in the world. And so why on earth would you open these things if you have a nuclear power disaster and contaminate this huge source of pure drinking water? And I know Mr. DeLorean has himself promoted nuclear power on some of your previous programs. And isn't this rather dangerous? It's very expensive to build these things, and also it'll take money away from other green energy projects.
Yeah, thanks.
Thanks,
Joanne. And you're correct. On previous shows, I have voiced support for nuclear power. And I even told the story how I came about that, going from as a young kid protesting at the gates to coming around to promoting it. You talked about, or you used the term green energy, which is a little bit of a less precise term than low or no emissions, because it's greenhouse gas emissions, CO2 and methane and a few others, that really make the difference when it comes to climate change. And so nuclear power essentially doesn't have any greenhouse gas emissions. And the other thing I've noted on previous shows is certainly there is a nuclear waste issue. and that still needs to be grappled with more. A lot of the nuclear waste is currently stored on site at the nuclear plants. Again, to reiterate, I believe that we can politically and technologically address that waste issue easier than we can address the carbon emissions that come from millions, if not billions, of different point sources around the world. And so I think we're at the point where we have no choice but to look at nuclear as a no-emission source. As to the Great Lakes, just like other power plants, coal or oil or natural gas, most of them are placed where there is a body of water, because basically they're heating things up to produce steam that runs a turbine that generates electricity. And so you're always using water for that. In terms of, you know, nuclear accidents, there have been, you know, places like Fukushima and so on. I think in each case, the nuclear industry has learned from that and they've made the situation better. The other thing that I want to note is the small modular nuclear reactors. It's not all going to be the big type of reactors that I think generate the most fear because of past problems. The small nuclear reactors will not have as much radioactive matter that they use and process, and I think, you know, that is going to be another part of the future. But I do believe nuclear has to be part of the equation here.
It seems, though, of those of us of a certain age grew up learning that, I live near Three Mile Island, for God's sakes. You know, it was the boogeyman. And so now to turn around and as Joanne mentioned, and then to have the governor saying, oh, we ought to be doing this, we ought to be doing that. I'm not arguing your message. What I'm asking is the journey that you took to get where you are now, and given the information that you have at your fingertips, I'm just wondering globally how that's going to go over, because so many of us have grown up with this perception.
Well, I mean, globally, nuclear is doing just fine. I mean, yes. And I know there was, you know, there's the Fukushima thing in Japan or whatever. Yeah. France generates most of its electricity from nuclear. But I guess I want to also just for a moment.
I guess when I meant globally, I meant in the larger picture, and even just say New York. You know, like you have the governor now saying, well, let's do this. And I think there's a lot of people who say, oh, but you told us wrong. We shouldn't do this.
Yeah, I saw an article, it must have been in the New York Times just a few days ago, and maybe it was an opinion piece, but I don't think so. And it was talking about the shutdown of Indian Point.
Right.
And the fact that there are a lot of people second-guessing now, based on the electricity situation, whether or not that should have been done. But I guess, you know, the other thing to close out on is, and not to make excuses, but nothing is perfect. I mean, coal generation generates a tremendous amount of other types of pollutants that have direct impact on health, especially local health, in terms of the heavy metals and mercury that are emitted. Natural gas has its own problems. So, you know, the only really non-problematic things might be solar and wind, but you know, we have to get over that hump, and we have to have policy in place to recognize that.
And I know this may sound like a smart alecky question, but I mean it seriously. But I mean, down the line, we're not going to be saying, "Well, you know, we should be thinking about this fracking idea."
I'm not sure. I understand fracking, but I'm not sure I understand the question, Joe.
Meaning that down the line, we think of that as a positive thing to be done, as opposed to as a negative thing to be done.
Yeah, I don't think so, because, I mean, if you get into the climate data, I mean, we are in tough shape. We are in bad shape in terms of the climate data and the temperature rises year by year. And so I believe, I certainly hope, that people will begin to recognize that It's all about CO2. It's all about greenhouse gases, and that needs to be the eye of the needle through which everything must pass.
Dan DeLoria is our guest on Vox Pop this afternoon. We welcome your calls, 1-800-348-2551. Go to Chris now in Housatonic. Go, Chris.
Yeah, Joe. And I'd be getting your name.
It's Dan.
It's
I
Dan.
I was watching Dr. Ian, but I was watching the day after tomorrow, the last week or last Sunday.
Yeah.
Now, could that happen to us in real lifetime?
Do you know what day after tomorrow is?
If I've got those pictures straight, that's the one where everything happens very fast and New York City ices over. Is that the one?
Yes.
Yeah. I am not a climate scientist, first of all, but I think I know enough to say that, no, that cannot happen on that type of speed. I mean, theoretically, it could happen at some point in the future if we really let everything happen without any intervention, but it's not something that would happen like that. I mean, that was a dramatization of, I mean, part of it was the ice shelves and what was happening up there. And I have to apologize. I don't even remember how exactly New York froze over in that. But,
well, there's our homework. We'll go back. We'll watch
back. I should watch that because, I mean, I saw it when it first came out.
Yeah.
And it gets talked about a lot, but I only have a little bit of a vague memory on it.
All right. Let's go to Christopher now in Kingston, New York. Christopher, go ahead.
Good afternoon, Dan and Joe. My question is, given the fairly ubiquitous availability of geothermal, why isn't there more investment in developing this technology, both monetarily and policy-wise?
That is a great question, Chris, and I was about to mention geothermal when Joe brought up fracking, because there's a lot of activity in the geothermal world right now. And basically, it's a case of, in the past, geothermal energy to produce electricity or for district heating or whatever only happened where there was a close-to-the-surface geothermal source. And so it was basically easy to do. You just drilled straight down and got it, tapped into it, and so on. In a strange twist of fate, the technology of fracking and the drilling techniques that were used is now being applied to geothermal, and it's opened up entirely new locations where geothermal energy can be used. There are folks in the geothermal energy that say basically we can do it anywhere. You know, this is the source, they argue, that you tell me where the data center is going to go, and we'll put a geothermal generation facility next to it. So we're going to see a lot more on geothermal. There are some I was going to say hot new companies, but that's probably an unintended pun.
Yes, yes.
And but there is a lot of investment in it. There's a lot of interest in it, and so you're going to see more. And I'm not sure I can go beyond that. But it's definitely on the horizon.
Does that answer your question, Christopher?
Absolutely.
All right. Thank you very much for the call. While you were talking to Christopher, I quickly Googled chances of us icing over like day after tomorrow. And it says that 87% of climate scientists say it can't happen.
It can't happen.
It can't happen.
Yeah.
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 These changes, even for a regional cooling event, would occur over decades or longer, not days. The immense mass of the Earth's oceans and glaciers prevents such rapid shifts in climate.
Yeah.
So we'll go with that.
Okay.
All right.
Thanks.
Let's see. Who do I owe a phone call to? We go to Paul in Troy, New York. Hello, Paul.
Good afternoon. Two quick comments and a question.
Great.
I went to a college in the New York City area that tapped into geothermal many years ago and still does to help generate power for the entire campus. Second, however many deniers there are, the moon is not made out of green cheese, and climate change is with us, whether they acknowledge it or not. Here's my question. I haven't heard much discussion of it lately, but is there any efforts underway, and I'm not sure how to put a label on it, of tapping into the power that's generated by tides and by ocean waves? That's an enormous amount of power that's unleashed every day everywhere in the world, and I'm wondering if there's any efforts to try to harness that incredible amount of power.
The answer is yes, and at the risk of another pun, investment and experimentation with tidal power has gone up and down over the years. There was an effort going all the way back into the Obama administration. There were some projects that were attempted in areas that had, like the Bay of Fundy, that had great tidal change, and they were abandoned. They basically could not make the cost curve. The power could not be generated economically enough. Uh-huh. But, I mean, there's a case of where, just like with other things, we talked about the solar panels, technology improvements improve the efficiency and lower the cost. And so tidal power is being experimented with again. The other thing that is happening is not just the tidal power, but wave power. And, yeah, and there are floating technologies mm-hmm. that can be used that, just due to the oscillation, can generate electricity. I'm not aware of any that have been connected to a grid or anything like that. But again, you know, we're going to see other things like that going forward, especially if they can produce lower cost. I mean, here's one of the problems right now is that, like, the administration is forcing coal plants to stay open. Coal plants are the highest cost power plant on the grid. Solar and wind produce the cheapest electricity on the grid. And so we sort of have it all backwards here in terms of, and here we get away from climate, but we talk about the cost of a homeowner's utility bill. And so if you really come down to it, you've got the cleanest being the cheapest, and yet, you know, we're in danger of not going there. I'm right. Sorry to go off on that.
But, no, it's important. Yeah.
Tell it to National Grid. Hydroelectric power, right?
Have a conversation
right?
with them.
Oh, no. Thank you, Public Service Commission. Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Paul,
okay, thank
pleasure
you, Paul.
To speak with you. Thank you very much. You know, I'm glad Paul brought it up because I forgot. I remember the moon of cheese. I forgot it was green. I don't know how I forgot that, but the green cheese of the moon.
I agree, yeah.
Yeah,
I guess,
but
the moon is made of cheese. And,
yeah. Let's see. We have some questions here. We can get those in through the email and get those in before break. By the way, while we're here talking about arguably the most important topic of our time.
I know what you're about to say.
All of the news networks have broken because Taylor Swift and Travis Kelce are getting married. So I feel proud that we're talking about this right now. It's good to be here. We go to Alan in Williamstown, who says, I saw a story a few years ago on CBS Sunday Morning about how the plastic we recycle used to be sent to China to be recycled, but no longer, and it's just thrown away like regular garbage. Is there truth to this?
Well, I'm not a plastics guy, is the first thing I want to say. The second thing I want to say, that from a climate standpoint and emission standpoint, recycling is kind of far down on the list in terms of your personal recycling at home and your carbon footprint. I have read stories as well, Alan, about the amount of plastics that are not recycled. I think what you're referring to, I don't know if you said China or whatever.
Yeah,
but
China.
There are places that have accepted plastic that are now saying, no, we're not going to accept that any longer, which sort of flips it back to us in terms of trying to deal with plastics. But But I really don't know the details on that. I apologize.
I will say that our Judith Henk has a brand new book called The Problem with Plastic that will be out in the fall. And certainly the question is buried in that volume, which I'm just starting to read, and it's amazing. Yeah. But also her group Beyond Plastics can certainly tell you exactly where all that material is going. All right, let's go to a break. Zach is breaking things in the giving me the signs time to break. So we'll take a break and we'll be back after a little green cheese appetizer right after this. Welcome back, and we are having a Vox Pop this afternoon. We figured, oh, what the hell? Let's have a Vox Pop. Dan DeLury is our guest, Senior Fellow for Energy and Climate at Vermont Law and Graduate School, and joins us on the program this afternoon. We welcome your calls, 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org. I mentioned Judith Henk's great book, which is forthcoming. I don't want to. I also want to mention about your newsletter. You have a great newsletter where you write about all kinds of issues as they're happening.
Oh wow! Thanks, Joe. Yes, I don't have a book yet, but I have been putting out a newsletter for quite a while, and it essentially is in two parts. The first part is roughly, 25 news items where I just offer a quick opinion on those news items or why they're important or why they should be known about. But then I do essentially an op-ed. My op-ed and the issue that I put out last week was focusing on the temperature rise in Europe and what that means for tourism. The one I did before that was on the sudden deluge impact of climate, which we're seeing where 10 inches of rain falls in an hour without any warning, which we're seeing in Texas and in Florida and so on. So if you'd like to subscribe, just send me an email at DeLurieDan, DeLurieDan at gmail.com.
DeLurieDan at gmail.com, and get on the list for the newsletter. Let's go to Laura in Stockbridge, who has been waiting patiently. Hello, Laura. Go ahead.
Hi there. I have two comments and a question. My quick comment is that I needed a new roof on my house, and to do so, I replaced the solar panels from 2005, and I took the federal tax credit, and I recently added more solar panels for my EV car and heat pumps, and I also took the federal tax credit. In Massachusetts, you cannot take the Massachusetts tax credit, but the federal can, according to my what I've practiced with my accountant's help, and that would be one thing. The other, I would say that if you are replacing your solar panels, there is a secondary market, be it a farm that wants to use them to irrigate a field or something, so explore that as well. So that's one comment. The other comment is about recycling. It very much depends on the material and the markets and how the condition of that material. So my information really from my decades in working in the environment is that actually recycling is the most cost-effective BTU. With plastics, it does seem to track the price of oil. So when oil is expensive, it becomes more cost-effective than when oil is cheap, and there are many grades of plastic that are pretty useless. But it's always quantity versus quality. But that's the more I listen, the more comments I'll have. My question is...
We'll get to your question.
Do you have a good...
Get you out of traffic.
Here's my quick question, which is, we have a historic building that's going to be sort of gutted and rehabbed, and we're interested in solar, but it's historic, and the solar would face the road. And one of the thoughts that came up would be, what about the solar shingles? And for Western Mass, sort of where is the technology, where is the market, where is the infrastructure, is that something really that the time is now to pursue?
Wow. So, Joe, should we turn the rest of the show over?
Yeah, you want to do solar shingles for the rest of the
week? No, over to Laura with
all the comments.
I mean, thanks, Laura, for all of that. And you certainly get the Electrification Queen Award of the Week for all that you've done, and especially some of the things you've done that were I was asked about earlier. So I guess, you know, in terms of solar shingles, Tesla has them. I know they've deployed them in the Southwest mostly, according to my knowledge. I don't think they are, you know, catching fire. I wish I knew what the efficiencies were and what the issues were, but I think a lot of us thought that once they were available, they would catch fire and that people would use them more. But I'm sorry, that's as far as I can go. I mean, you've actually got more hands-on experience with solar panels than I do. One thing I want to pick up on, though, in terms of the farmers, another downside to current administration policy is they just stopped a program that was giving grants out of the Agriculture Department to farmers to install solar panels on their land. Which it's been demonstrated is a big income stream for farmers, and it does not preclude growing crops or grazing sheep under the panels. So in a reverse sort of way, you know, maybe there will be more farmers looking for those panels as you described it.
Laura, thank you very much for the telephone call. We appreciate it. Let's go to this email. Vincent says, given the nearly ubiquitous availability of geothermal, why isn't there a greater policy and monetary investment in this technology?
Well, there's good news on that front. Is geothermal is favored by the administration. It is said by some to fall under the umbrella of drill baby drill. And so geothermal, the tax credit, the investment tax credit for geothermal was preserved in the big budget bill. So, you know, coupling that with what I mentioned earlier about more and more companies entering that market in terms of providing the technology and building plants, I think you're just simply going to see more geothermal being deployed.
All right, let's go to the phones once again. We check in with Glenn in Rotterdam, New York. Hello, Glenn.
Hello, gentlemen. Got a question. Why has the nuclear industry moved away from General Electric reactors toward the Westinghouse Corporation reactors?
I just saw something recently where Westinghouse was not included on a list of nuclear reactors that were set to get certain funding or be eligible for fundings. But, I don't know the answer to your question in terms of, I thought the GE, and I almost remember the name of their technology. It starts with a V, Vernova or Vervona or something like that. I thought they are okay.
Is this something you heard about today?
I've heard it recently that originally the GE scientists did not want to make nuclear reactor power, but they took the Department of Energy corporate welfare money, and look where it ended them. They used to be the number one corporation in the world. And now they have to maintain all the reactors that are aging out and leaking all over the world. So I heard that Westinghouse was taking over to try and get some of the corporate welfare.
Yeah, I think the decline of GE is a larger story than just nuclear. But there is, maybe it's not part of, no, it is part of GE, this company that I'm thinking of that was spun out just to do nuclear. And in terms of, you know, which companies are which and how I would rate them, I can't really do that. I'm sorry.
All right.
They do have spinoffs that have led to them dumping waste into the Mohawk River here at Capel. So they do have their spinoffs.
Well, I don't know anything about that.
Yeah, sorry, I'm not familiar with that. Sorry.
But we were talking about, it's GE Vernova.
Vernova. Thank you.
All right, let's see. We have time for Dan, who is in Rotterdam. Hello, Dan.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I'm enjoying the show. I think something that's completely missed in the real world is the reason that steam locomotives are not on the rails today is cost. They're too expensive to make, too expensive to maintain, and too expensive to fuel. The same thing happens to electric cars in relationship to internal combustion motors. Internal combustion cars are too expensive to maintain, too expensive to build, have too many parts. How much energy from the fuel goes to moving the car forward in an electric car versus a gas car? Electric cars are going to win no matter what the fossil fuel industry says. Thanks.
Yeah, Joe, I don't know if because Joe gets my newsletter. So in the one previous to the one I just put out.
Two ago.
I included a link to a TikTok video that somehow I came across. And it's this British fellow talking about EVs versus internal combustion engine or ICE. And so he says, imagine if everybody, if the world was all electric vehicles and somebody showed up and he was trying to sell you an internal combustion engine. And so you ask him, well, what's the difference? And so the guy says, well, mine has like 247 moving parts as opposed to your five. Mine has a big container of flammable liquid somewhere in it, and yours doesn't have that. You know, you have to go to a special place to fuel up instead of doing it overnight at your home. And he went on and on. And, you know, it's easy to imagine. And so I agree with the caller. I'm a big promoter of EVs because they are simply a better car. And there is no stopping them, as I said earlier.
Let's go to, we're running out of time, but I want to get to everybody. We go to Nancy in Schenectady. Go ahead, Nancy.
Hi, I just wanted to mention that EPA currently has a public comment period, which ends, I think, September 22nd. It's been extended from September 16th to the 22nd. And it is on the issue of having been given in 2009, since 2009, they've been able to regulate emissions, carbon emissions that go into the atmosphere. And as of, they are looking to rescind having the ability to make this ruling over carbon emissions, which will end up with them not being able to have anything like, you know, electric vehicles. And I'm just wondering how far it'll go with the wind generation and all those other green energies are going to be no longer supported by EPA.
Thanks, Nancy. You've raised an important thing going on. Prior to 2009, greenhouse gases, or I should say carbon dioxide, was not recognized or officially called a pollutant. And in 2009, something happened called the endangerment finding. And that is the words to use if you're Googling this or trying to understand it. And the endangerment finding said that, yes, indeed, it is a pollutant. And that allowed a ton of pro-climate policy to be put in place since then. And so you're right that the current administration has said, you know, no, that's wrong. We're taking that away. And that's the proceeding going on at the EPA right now. And that's one that is open for comment by anyone.
Yeah, and people who are listening to this program may be interested in commenting on that.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I hope that people listening to this program take every opportunity at every level, and that includes your local government. I mean, local government is where we talk a lot about emissions reductions, but there's so much baked in to the atmosphere already that temperatures are going up. We're getting the sudden deluges, and it's local government that has to worry about resilience and adaptation. And I would encourage everyone to get active at some level in their local government in terms of how they're going to deal with that.
And thank you for the question, Nancy. That's a great point, and I thank you for making it. When it comes to the local governments, although they have to be up against it as far as financing and funding and figuring out how to do any of this stuff,
right?
Given what they're up against.
Yeah, but in that op-ed that I did about the sudden deluge,
yes.
I think the number was 500,000 or 600,000. You know, dams and even another half that of culverts that are spread around the U.S., many of which are key to, you know, what happens in that local government footprint in terms of the terrain,
right,
and all that. So yeah, I mean, it's going to require tons of money to adapt and to improve resilience. So I wish I could tell you where that money would come from. But again, it's something that as long as people are aware of it, then they can at least start to take some measures.
And obviously, it's easier to do it before a problem, before something gives out, before a road washes out, to do it
exactly
beforehand.
Exactly.
Than it is after,
exactly,
after the fact.
So, you know, let's not forget about the fact that we're already in this mess and
right,
that we have to focus on resilience and adaptation.
When you talk about resilience, obviously, and adaptation, and we're still learning about adapting and figuring out new things.
Yeah, I mean, it's a kind of a touchy-feely thing in some respects, because our brain is still not wired to say that this has happened and it's not going back. You know, we're not going back to the way it was. We're simply not. And so it's hard for our brains to get around that.
I always like ending a show with the touchy-feely stuff. That's good. That's the way we should end all these shows. Dan DeLuria is our guest of Vermont Law and Graduate School. I want to thank him so much for being with us today. Dan, what a pleasure. So great to have you here.
Oh, thank you, Joe.
Be well.
I love doing it.
Support for Vox Pop comes from Prestwick Chase, independent living community offering social, cultural, and educational activities. Amid 120 acres of natural woodscape in historic Saratoga Springs, PrestwickChase.com. Hyde Collection in Glens Falls, exploring prosperity and exclusion. European prints from 1500 to 1850 on view through September 21st. Open Thursday through Sunday, 10 to 5. HydeCollection.org, and Bonham and Douglas Architects, an architecture and interior design studio designing education facilities, including Deerfield Academy's dining hall, bd-arc.com. Thanks to our engineer, Zach Moy. Thanks to Andrea Leong for answering the phones. I'm Joe Donahue. Tomorrow it is Pets and Vets. That's at 2 o'clock. Stay tuned next for the book show, where you get to hear me again.